Michael Bloomberg is running for president, putting his media organization in a bind.
Bloomberg News is a very good news organization, and this just handcuffs them from doing what reporters have to do to cover a national political campaign.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for November 27th, a look at the ethical questions raised by Bloomberg's entrance into the race. Also on the podcast, native chefs are reshaping Thanksgiving by spotlighting indigenous food.
I've heard people on my podcast describe it as like an act of resistance, an act of spirituality, and really taking part in your culture and your religion.
Plus, 50 years ago, Native American activists occupied Alcatraz Island. We'll explore the legacy of that act of resistance.
Alcatraz was in many ways sort of the Montgomery bus boycott of the Native rights movement in this country.
But we start with Michael Bloomberg's presidential conundrum. Let's get going. On Sunday, 77-year-old former New York mayor and billionaire Michael Bloomberg announced that he was running for president.
If President Trump wins another term in office, we may never recover from the damage that he can do. The stakes could not be higher. We must win this election, and we must begin rebuilding America by investing here at home and restoring our nation's credibility and moral leadership abroad.
Bloomberg is already showing what a candidate with an estimated $54 billion net worth can do. In this week alone, Bloomberg will spend $31 million on television ads.
Mike Bloomberg for president. Jobs creator. Leader. Problem solver.
But what sets Bloomberg's campaign apart from those run by fellow billionaires like Tom Steyer and Donald Trump is that he also happens to be the owner of Bloomberg News, which is one of the largest news organizations in the country. The outlet is home to a network of 2,700 journalists and analysts. Within the Bloomberg News network, the former mayor's presidential run has inspired a great deal of tension. In a memo sent to staffers earlier this week, Bloomberg's editor-in-chief John Micklethwaite wrote that the company will, quote, continue our tradition of not investigating Mike and his family and foundation, and we will extend the same policy to his rivals in the Democratic primaries. Here's Bloomberg in 2018 speaking with Radio Iowa about how Bloomberg News might cover his campaign.
We've always had a policy of we don't cover ourselves. I happen to believe in my heart of hearts, you can't be independent, and nobody's going to believe that you're independent. And quite honestly, I don't want one of the reporters I'm paying to write a bad story about me. I don't want them to be independent. So you're going to have to do something.
But independence is at the core of journalism, and whether Bloomberg's editorial staff is making the right call in its 2020 coverage is where we begin today. Here to discuss what Mike Bloomberg's run means for his media company, Bloomberg News, are Paul Fahre, staff writer and reporter for The Washington Post, and Dan Kennedy, associate professor of journalism at Northeastern University and a media critic contributor at WGBH in Boston. Paul, Dan, welcome to the show.
Hi, Tanzina.
Thank you.
Paul, Bloomberg editor-in-chief John Micklethwaite made a decision not to investigate Michael Bloomberg, which is a continuation of past policy. Will this hurt the company's ability to effectively and thoroughly cover the presidential race because they're only covering President Trump?
I think it's hard to make the argument that this is the full and complete coverage of the campaign. Bloomberg News is a very good news organization, and this just handcuffs them from doing what reporters have to do to cover a national political campaign. It has perplexed, to use a nice word, the journalists over at Bloomberg. They don't know exactly where this leaves them. And I'd have to say that any news organization facing this, the journalists would have a big problem with it.
Dan, Micklethwaite said that if Bloomberg becomes the nominee, the Bloomberg News outlet would have to reassess, now I'm quoting here, how to cover him. What do you think that reassessment could look like, and why not reassess right now when he's a candidate?
Well, reassessing right now would be a very good move. What I hope, and I have no evidence for this, but I think it would be a fairly decent outcome, is that Bloomberg himself is kind of dipping his toe in the water of a presidential campaign at this point. It's very much a long shot, but if he really starts to gain traction and seems to be on his way to being a serious contender for the nomination, my hope is that he would reassess and perhaps put Bloomberg News in a blind trust or maybe even sell it as quickly as he can in order to end this really difficult conflict of interest.
The union at Bloomberg News released a statement on Twitter on Monday saying that they were, quote, extremely alarmed by management's decision to what they're calling silence journalists. Paul, you work for The Washington Post, which is owned by Jeff Bezos and who owns Amazon. And then The Washington Post continues to report on Amazon. I've worked for The New York Times that had to report on itself and everything from earnings reports to deeper issues here. I mean, is this really a silencing of journalists? Are there other organizations that have this sort of line in the sand?
Well, let me tell you about how the Washington Post covers Jeff Bezos. And the answer is aggressively, with really no holds barred. We are not ordered not to write certain things about him. We can write pretty much what we want. And when we have any discussion of Amazon, we disclose that. In Bloomberg case, they have always had this weird policy of not reporting on their owner's wealth, his his personal life, his family stories, and they're continuing that. More importantly, they're extending, as Micklethwaite said in his memo, they're extending that to other Democratic candidates. So what you have now is, we're not going to cover those aspects of Bloomberg. We're not going to cover those aspects of his rivals for the Democratic nomination. At the same time, they are going to continue investigating those aspects of President Trump. So you have this very unlevel playing field now. No Democrats, no enterprise stories about Democrats, including Bloomberg, but will continue to look into the president. It just looks unfair.
And it's all, I mean, Bloomberg and Donald Trump, Bloomberg has clearly gunned for Donald Trump in his statements. This is why he's running. It just presents, I think, for political reporters, Dan, and I'm curious your thoughts here, what position this puts the political reporters in, to Paul's point, who won't be able to report on any of these Democratic candidates. And what do you end up doing with those folks?
I think that you try to keep them from resigning and taking jobs at the New York Times and the Washington Post. It's an incredibly difficult situation. It's completely untenable. And what happens if Bloomberg does somehow manage to win the nomination? At that point, does Bloomberg News say, oh, and by the way, we're not going to do any investigative pieces about President Trump either, because since we're not going to do that about Bloomberg, we don't want to do it about his rival. This is one of the weirder and more disturbing things I've heard about a news organization doing in quite some time.
Paul, we've also learned that several members of Bloomberg's editorial staff are temporarily leaving their positions to work on Bloomberg's campaign. Is this within the regular scope of an editorial staff member's job? And just to be clear, these are not news reporters who are out working beats, but these are the folks who work, on opinion and editorial content. But even with that, I mean, has there ever been a precedent for this, Paul?
No, there's no precedent for this. The closest I could think of was Steve Forbes, who was the editor and basically the owner of Forbes magazine back in 1996 when he ran for president, for a Republican nomination, at least. And, but Bloomberg News is not Forbes magazine. Forbes magazine is what came out every 2 weeks. It was a magazine. Bloomberg has TV, it has radio, it has an online presence. It's a huge news organization and many, many readers. The editorial side thing is really weird. It's one thing to close down any kind of editorials about the campaign, any unsigned editorials, they are stopping that completely. But now you have seven members of the editorial board, including the top two editors, joining his campaign. That presents its own kind of suspicious cloud of journalistic malpractice, or at least, suspicion around Bloomberg, which is his operation, an extension of his campaign. And in this case, yes, it is. These people are joining his campaign. They are there to promote Bloomberg's candidacy.
Dan, what are some of the fears of having a candidate running for president like Bloomberg, who also owns a multinational media organization, to Paul's point, which is not just, you know, a printed magazine? I mean, this is television. This is beyond that. So what are some of the concerns here?
Well, it seems like it's a ratcheting up of what we've seen in recent years to some extent, because although candidate Trump did not have his own news organization behind him, nevertheless, he was essentially a creation of the media through his participation in the Apprentice all those years, and this seems to be really the next step. Now, in terms of covering national politics, Bloomberg News is really a niche player, and the idea that they could make or break any candidate is fairly unlikely. But indeed, what happens if we go down the line and Jeff Bezos, Paul's ultimate boss, decides to run for president? As Paul correctly points out, Bezos has been very good about letting letting the Washington Post cover his interests without fear or favor. But you could see that if he ran for president, it might be a very different sort of situation. Maybe Bezos would give the same edict and say, you can cover me any way you want, but I don't know whether the public would believe that. And unfortunately, they would be able to point to this Bloomberg situation as a precedent.
Paul, doesn't Mike Bloomberg really ultimately, I mean, he owns the company, it's his brainchild. Doesn't he have the right to say, look, you know, these are my rules, my company, my organization, you know, to play by the rules, or you can walk?
Sure, he certainly does. Every owner does, and every owner imposes some rules on its newsroom. But in this case, it creates perception, and his readers, his viewers, his listeners of Bloomberg News are going to be asking the question, am I getting the straight goods from them? Can I trust them as a news organization? And I want to take exception to something that Dan just said. They are a niche player. They are strong in financial news. Their terminals go into every stock trading and financial firm in America and around the world. But what we don't know in this case is what won't be reported because of these policies that they've imposed. We don't know what stories a Bloomberg reporter might uncover and not report because they now have a practice of stopping themselves from reporting certain things about the candidates. So, niche player or not, you don't want to take reporters off the field and not report.
Paul Fahre is a staff writer and reporter for The Washington Post, and Dan Kennedy is an associate professor of journalism at Northeastern University and a media critic contributor at WGBH in Boston. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Staples like turkey, mashed potatoes, and cranberry sauce tell us one Thanksgiving story. But in recent years, there's also been a resurgence of dishes championed by Native American and Indigenous chefs. Many of these chefs are working to center ingredients and recipes found in North America prior to colonization.
We're talking about food from 573 different tribes, and those are just 573 federally recognized tribes. There are more that are state recognized, or even more that disappeared.
That's Andy Murphy, the host of the podcast Toasted Sister and a radio producer for Native America Calling.
So we're talking about those ingredients that are specific to those tribes, and each of those tribes has, you know, a culture kind of built around those foods specifically. I mean, these foods are part of different stories and different origin stories, but it's so very specific and so very personal to each tribe.
She told me that while dishes like fry bread often come to mind when non-Indigenous people think of Native food, there's actually an incredible amount of diversity within Native cuisine.
This movement is about moving away from that and changing our food identity to something that is traditional, that is that personal, local food that is part of our ancestry, part of our DNA.
if you're on social media, particularly if you're following younger cooks and chefs and progressive activists, a lot of people are calling this the decolonize your diet or decolonize your meals or even for this holiday, decolonize your Thanksgiving. What does that mean?
That means to really look at those traditional foods in your tribe that have been a part of, you know, the culture since time immemorial. That's using ingredients that are not pork and beef and lard and these things that have been forced on us. And it's also, you know, it's not just like the ingredients that you're bringing into your holiday dinners and into your diet. It's having that kind of understanding, cultural understanding, because it's, you know, food for, you know, Native people is more than just something that we put in our mouths. I've heard people on my podcast describe it as like an act of resistance, an act of spirituality, and really taking part in your culture and your religion. So it's also recognizing that part of Native food.
We're right on the cusp of Thanksgiving, and there's obviously a lot of mythology around how Thanksgiving came to be and what food is at the center of the Thanksgiving table. We know that traditionally, at least in the American psyche, it's a turkey with some potatoes and some green beans. How do we decolonize that?
So turkeys are native to North America, so I guess we could still have that turkey. We could really look at the traditional squashes. The native farmers and seed keepers are working really hard to revitalize and grow in our own communities again. Those traditional varieties of corn, we could also just have, I guess, conversations with our elders about the foods that they were eating long time ago. I know it can be pretty hard to, you know, this close to Thanksgiving to sort of rethink a whole menu, but it takes time. You know, even in Native America, it's not happening that fast to change our diets and start adding more traditional decolonized ingredients to our dinner tables.
When you were growing up, what did the Thanksgiving table look like, or what did Thanksgiving mean to you?
Thanksgiving, you know, a long time ago when I was a kid, was really fun. I mean, we brought home our arts and crafts from school that had pilgrims and turkeys and Indians on them. We really had no understanding of the real history and atrocities of Thanksgiving. So, you know, in my earlier days, it was really fun. We got to spend time with family and have really good food. And we just had the regular, you know, Thanksgiving foods, turkey, yams with the marshmallows on top of them. Everything had like a stick of butter in it. And then when we went to college, I'm talking about me and my sister, she's only a year younger than me. But when we went to college, we enrolled ourselves in American Indian Studies courses where we learned Native history that we had never been taught before in our public schools. So we learned Native history. We learned the real history of Thanksgiving. And for a couple of years during our college years, we were pretty angry at the Thanksgiving table. But it's hard to just like sit there and be angry. Like for me, I slowly, like after a couple of years, let that anger go. And I think a lot of Native people, when they go through Indian Studies courses, they have like a couple of years of anger. And sometimes they carry that with them, but I kind of dropped it and learned to just keep that in the past, but, you know, sometimes use it for inspiration for some of the work that I do.
So, Andy, if somebody is listening to this and says, well, I kind of want to see what Native food is, where do they begin? I mean, where do they go? Where should they look? What is something that is accessible that they might be able to start with?
Well, they can look in their own area. There are tribes all over the place. There are tribes in your area right now. You are on Native land, so you should look in your own area to see if there are tribes there that are working towards food sovereignty, because they might have farms that sell these things, that sell traditional food. They might have online businesses where you can pay for shipping and have it shipped to your house. Like I do, I get like maple syrup and wild rice and, you know, cornmeal shipped to me from all these different native producers. So they're out there. You just have to look for it. And, you know, I've been asked this question many times before because of my podcast. People are like, where can I get these things? I'm so excited. I'm starting to put together like a database in my Toasted Sister website, which is toastedsisterpodcast.com. And I'm trying to put all those native food producers on there so people can open up that page and look and see in different regions what tribes, what entrepreneurs are producing what and selling it for, you know, people like me who want to have these things in their pantry. So look in your area. People are having, you know, food celebrations and harvest celebrations. Sometimes, most times, they're open to the public.
Andy Murphy is the host of the podcast Toasted Sister and a radio producer for Native America Calling. Andy, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Years ago this month, a group of Native American activists launched a 19-month occupation of Alcatraz Island in the San Francisco Bay. They were protesting the government's mistreatment of indigenous communities, including efforts to strip tribes of their land and status as sovereign nations, and to assimilate the Native population into wider American society. The activists attempted to reclaim Alcatraz Island as their own, citing an 1868 treaty that allowed Native Americans to take over surplus federal land. The island had been sitting idle since 1963, when the famed federal prison shuttered its doors.
In the name of all Indians, therefore, we reclaim this land for our Indian nations. For all these reasons, we feel this claim is just and proper, and that this land should rightfully be granted to us for as long as the river shall run and the sun shall shine. Signed, Indians of All Tribes, November 1969, San Francisco, California.
That's the late Richard Oakes, one of the leaders of the movement.
This island here represents no man's land and every man's land. It represents to the Indians a place, a sounding board where they can get the attention of the public, they get the attention of the press, and get the attention of the government officials.
Oakes and his fellow activists transformed Alcatraz Island into a symbol of Native resistance. And while they didn't succeed in reclaiming the island itself, they thrust Native American civil rights into the national spotlight and created a wider sense of cultural pride and identity among Native people. The occupation was also one of the driving forces behind a shift in federal policy toward self-determination for Native American tribes in the 1970s. And in many ways, the occupation of Alcatraz laid the groundwork for the indigenous activism we're seeing today, with movements like the Dakota Access Pipeline Standing Rock protest. For more on this, I spoke to Ken Blancett, an associate professor of history and Native American studies at the University of Nebraska, Omaha, and also Julian Brave Noisecat, a journalist and activist who recently led an indigenous canoe journey around Alcatraz Island to commemorate the anniversary of the occupation. And I started by asking Kent how the Alcatraz occupation fit into the broader picture of civil rights in the 1960s.
There was a lot of communication between these movements. They were supporting one another, and they were creating a kind of drive to create new kinds of ideas of unity within this country, but also to create a political base that can move things legislatively as well and make positive change. And that's something really critical that I showcase to my students. When they start to learn this, they start to realize, you know, those students that took over Alcatraz were not too much different than us. In other words, students can still make change in this country. And I think there's kind of an uplift to that and a positive direction for all students to be able to kind of learn from Alcatraz.
Julian, when we think about indigenous activism and the Red Power movement after the Alcatraz occupation, where did it go from there?
So after Alcatraz, there was a period of about 5 years of Native activism, most notably with the American Indian Movement, which did not lead the Alcatraz occupation, but got involved towards the end and then led things like the Trail of Broken Treaties across the United States and the occupation of Wounded Knee in 1973. And so there was a real flourishing of Native activism and a real cultural renaissance that sort of emerged out of this period that began with the Alcatraz occupation.
What is the state of Native activism and indigenous activism today?
We still struggle with a basic problem of visibility. You know, Native people have been erased and marginalized in American society. Alcatraz was in many ways sort of the Montgomery bus boycott of the Native rights movement in this country. And even in places like Oakland and Berkeley, you know, some of the most progressive, liberal places in the country, kids grow up not knowing that that's part of their history, that when they look out on the bay and they look at Alcatraz Island, there was this touchstone moment in the history of indigenous peoples and of this entire country, and it happened right here.
Now, Julian, obviously a lot has changed since 1969, and I'm wondering how social media and more broadly the internet are shaping this new era of indigenous activism.
I think that the power of media generally, and then social media specifically, is that it can provide that access, that representation. And when you have fewer gatekeepers, fewer traditional media gatekeepers, I think that the barriers to entry for groups like, you know, Native people who, you know, you'd be hard-pressed to find a Native American in the newsroom of the New York Times, the Washington Post, or at any of the cable networks, or in Hollywood. But you can find us online very easily if you go to the right corners of the internet. And I think that I see a lot of young people, people younger than I am even, using platforms to express their political views, you know, to take their culture into new digital directions. There are now, you know, many Native folks who are intervening in our cultural landscape, and that digital media, social media has provided them a tool, provided us a tool to do that work.
And Kent, just to sort of round this out here, I mean, we've mentioned the Dakota Access Pipeline a couple times, but here on The Takeaway, we've covered many issues that affect the indigenous community here in the United States, including the crisis of missing and murdered indigenous women and girls, healthcare disparities, and environmental justice, just to name a few. Have those issues been the same as they were 50 years ago? Are there new issues emerging for this community when it comes to civil rights and social justice that we should be paying attention to? Or have any of these improved?
Well, in America, we have a long way to go for equality for indigenous peoples. The issue of oppression has never been abated. The issue of colonization has never been abated. These are issues that are alive and strong and well within pockets of America. And they're issues that we as communities and nations have to face. Kind of the reason why, when we pull back from this and we look at one of Richard Oak's most famous quotes, which was, "Alcatraz is not an island, it's an idea," it becomes a very powerful kind of driven force within the movement of activism in Indian country, is to take direct action, but do that in a nonviolent way, to think indigenous in those solutions. And in the course of that is to create a new wave of activism that can transform our rights. And you got to scratch your head a bit. And like you said, wonder why there's such an epidemic with murdered and missing indigenous women. Why do we have Mauna Kea in Hawaii? Why do we have Standing Rock? Why are we still going over these issues where we have to educate a greater public about treaty rights? And some of that does have to do with our educational system. It has to do with curriculum, but it also has to do with larger systems of colonization. And unless we start attacking this as communities together and addressing it, we won't see significant change for some time. And I think that's the critical issue here.
So, I mean, I think one more element of this that has certainly changed in the last 50 years is that climate change has emerged as an issue that was only really a theory in some small scientific circles in, you know, 1969. And one of the fascinating things I would say about the movement, you know, for climate justice right now is that so often indigenous communities like Standing Rock are on the front lines of that movement, are playing an outsized role really in calling attention to environmental injustice.
Julian Brave Noisecat is a journalist and activist, and Kent Blancett is an associate professor of history and Native American studies at the University of Nebraska, Omaha. Thanks so much for this conversation.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
And that's our show for today, and we'll still be on air tomorrow during the holiday, so be sure to tune in. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and have a happy Thanksgiving.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.